Jim Ross, the Chevy, George J. James Hurst, and Scott C. Parton, Appaloosa.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Kevin O'Donnell. I represent James Shin, appellant. May I please reserve 1 minute for rebuttal?
You're the first lawyer this week who has asked for a reservation of rebuttal. And I want to tell you, pass it on to the other lawyers in the Commonwealth. If you want my assistance, you need to ask for it.
Yes,
thank you for being the first lawyer who has done that this week.
Your Honor, the trial court erred in granting the defendant's special plea bar for two reasons. First, the trial court erred in misapplied this court's ruling in McDonald and Norfolk and the progeny that was outlined in the cases cited by both parties when it determined that my client's injuries were and the nuisance was not of a permanent nature or was of a permanent nature and determined that the statute of limitations expired 2007. The second error the trial court made was it wrongly determined that my client, that the interference by the defendant was substantial and reasonable starting in 1997 and that the statute of limitations expired in 2002. Reading the trial court's ruling in its letter opinion, it stated as follows, the defendant's freedom system is a lawful structure. That being so, plaintiff's claims are not actionable until he suffers injuries from the drainage system. Plaintiff states in his complaint that his building has suffered water damage from the drainage system since 1997. Therefore, it became actionable in 2002. Nowhere in any of the opinions cited in Norfolk or McDonald or any of the other opinions cited in any of the case law before this court does the question of whether or not the nuisance is permanent or not turn on whether it's a lawful structure. In looking at Norfolk, Norfolk states that the question is whether the act creating the nuisance of a permanent is of a permanent nature or not. Unfortunately, Norfolk does not give trial courts really a clear list of factors or clear bright-line tests for the trial courts to consider when determining whether a nuisance is of a permanent nature or not. Looking at the various case law, including Norfolk, McDonald, Southern Railroad Co., which was cited in appellee's brief, there is a list of factors that the court can consider. And putting all those all together, some of those factors include whether the nuisance is, or whether the structure erected was lawful or unlawful, whether the nuisance is productive of all the damage which can ever result from it, whether the nuisance destroys the estate for all practical purposes, is the nuisance continuous necessarily an injury, is the nuisance such a permanent nature as it will continue without change from any cause without human labor, and whether the wrongful act is continuous or does it occur at intervals. What I'm asking the court to do today is to kind of clarify the court's holdings in Norfolk, McDonald, and come up with a better test for the trial court to consider. What I'm asking the court to do today is to, the question I think is simply stated as whether or not the nuisance is of a permanent nature or not, whether it's permanent or continuous.
May I interrupt you, counsel, for a moment? I take it you haven't had a chance to review our Forest Lakes opinion from a couple of weeks ago?
I had a chance to review it earlier this morning. And I think while that does clarify it a bit, it states that there is an exception, which is set forth in McDonald. But I'm still asking the court to come up with a list of factors. What the test that I envision is...
Well, assuming the test is Forest Lakes, explain to us how the trial court's decision was in violation of the principles of Forest Lakes.
Well, the only decision the trial court made was that the structure was lawful and therefore statute of limitations ran in 1997 or 2002 when the defendant purchased the building.
I thought his principal holding was the damages began in 97 and it was continuous from that point forward.
In reading the court's opinion, the trial court's opinion, it never says that the damages were continuous. It says that the building was lawful and therefore the statute of limitations began running in 1997. It's clear from the pleadings, and we relied on the pleadings, it's clear from the pleadings that the damages suffered by my client were not continuous. The nuisance was not the erection of the roof or the drainage system. The nuisance was the diversion of water from the defendant's roof onto my client's roof. And the pleadings were very clear that that only occurred during heavy rainstorms. It doesn't occur during normal rainstorms. It only occurs under certain conditions. The trial court also tried to clarify, make a distinction between McDonald and Norfolk. First of all, I don't think there is any distinction between McDonald and Norfolk. I think they stand for the same principles. If there is a distinction, I think McDonald is a better case for this court to follow in the specific factual scenario presented to the court today. McDonald, the erection of the pump station was not the nuisance. It was the discharge of the sewage onto the plaintiff's property in that case, which only occurred, as this court cited in Forrest, 9 times over 12 years. Similarly, in this case, it wasn't the erection of the roof, it wasn't the drainage system that was covered up in 1997. It was the discharge of water onto my client's roof, which only occurred during heavy rainstorms.
Counsel, why isn't your case governed by Southern Railway versus White and Southern Railway versus McManaman, where it wasn't constant, it occurred when there were heavy rains, but the same principle of where the structure is permanent and will continue indefinitely. There is but a single action, therefore, and the entire damage suffered, both past and present, must be recovered in that action. Why don't those two cases govern your facts?
Your Honor, the distinction there is, in that case, the flooding was so heavy and it was so significant that it essentially destroyed the plaintiff's property for all practical purposes. And there, the facts were that flooding flooded several people's property to the point where it significantly reduced the value of their property. And the court relied on that factor in saying that because it destroyed the estate for all practical purposes.
It said seriously damaged it. I don't see language of destruction for all practical purposes.
Well, the other thing I will say about that case, Your Honor, is it talked about it being a permanent menace, which is one of the factors, one of the five factors or five or six factors that if you look at all this case law, when answering the question whether it's permanent or a continuous injury, one of the factors they look at is whether the act is such a permanent nature as will continue without change from any cause without human labor, which is what it seemed to rely on in that case. What I'm asking the court to do is it seems like many of these cases, they pick one of these five factors and they say, this is what I'm going to hang my hat on. This is what I'm going to rely on to determine whether it's permanent or continuous nuisance. I'm asking the court to have a test where you have several factors, that you balance those factors out and come to a correct determination. I think in that case, they rely too heavily on whether or not that culvert could be changed by human labor. Looking at Norfolk, there is a bit of language in Norfolk about human labor, but one of the examples used in Norfolk, one of the hypotheticals they use is a mill dam, and it says one of the clear distinctions is if a mill dam is constructed and its flooding is so substantial that it destroys the estate for all practical purposes, then that is a permanent nuisance. If there is less serious flooding on a continuous or at intervals, then that is not a permanent nuisance. Which shows the fault in the human labor factor that several of these cases in which Appelli relies on, that human labor factor. I don't think that's a perfect test, and so I think in Southern Railway, they rely too heavily on that test. In the facts in this present case, if you look at those factors, it's clear that the trial court erred. One, the trial court didn't apply any of these factors. It applied whether or not the property was lawful or unlawful, and nowhere in the case law does it say that this question of permanence versus continuous nuisance relies on whether it's lawful or unlawful. But if you look at the factors, if you take all this case law and look at those factors, it's clear that my client suffered a continuous nuisance, that the nuisance caused by defendants of a continuous nature and not a permanent nature.
Can you repeat that? Since 1997, you're saying that the damages have been continuous?
I'm saying that Your Honor, I'm saying that the nuisance was of a continuous nature. It wasn't of a permanent nature. So starting, if it was of a permanent nature, I would agree that my client would have had to have brought the action within 5 years of 1997. But since it was continuous nature and that the injuries occurred at intervals, he has a new 5-year statute of limitation each time an injury occurred. So when he brought the action in 2015, he could only bring damages for the previous 5 years.
So the damages were not continuous. What are you saying about continuous?
The nuisance was of a continuous nature. The damages were at intervals. And so he had the previous 5 years. If you look at the factors, does the act destroy the estate for all practical purposes? No. In this case, the nuisance does not destroy the estate for all practical purposes. The pleadings say that in 1997 he was running a business on the first floor of the building, that the rain only caused the nuisance, that the discharge only occurred during heavy rainstorms, which do not occur regularly. Is it of such a permanent nature that it will continue without change from any cause without human labor? I think that
you seem to try to tee up a test for damages as sort of qualitative in nature, but isn't damage damage? In other words, the fact that given the way he was set up, it wasn't that much of an impediment, and so that's not that big of a deal, but isn't damage damage?
Yes, sir. And you know, I apologize for not being clear. I think there were two arguments. There was one, whether the interference was substantial and reasonable, which goes to that question.
Okay.
It wasn't substantial and reasonable until 2014 when he renovated the top two floors of the building. Whether it's a permanent or continuous nuisance or not is not qualitative. It looks at the nature of the nuisance. The nature of the nuisance was not the drainage system that was created in 1997. That in and of itself, the covering up the drainage system in 1997 in and of itself didn't cause a nuisance. If it's a normal rainfall, like you have several times a year, the rain collects on the roof and it just sits there. It's only when it's a serious, substantial rainfall that it collects on the roof to the point where it overflows onto my client's roof.
How many times a year is that? Do we have any idea?
At most once a year.
And how many times since 1977?
That was not in the pleadings, Your Honor. But what is in the pleadings is that from 1997 to 2014, he was running his business on the first floor. The top two floors were pretty much unoccupied and unused. That, yes, there was some damage over that time, but it was not substantial and reasonable.
Substantial and unreasonable, you seem to key that to your client's subjective view. But isn't that an objective test?
It is an objective test, Your Honor. And it seems to me that the court said basically as a matter of law, that the pleadings are not, that the facts pled in the pleadings do not meet the substantial and unreasonable test. However, my client didn't even get the opportunity to present evidence. There was no factual findings. It was basically the court made a ruling as a matter of law, and I think that was an error. I think to make that finding, we would have to have a trial, we would have to have evidence presented. And so I think that the trial court erred as a matter of law in making that decision. But I would agree with Your Honor, it is an objective test. My client, subjectively, he didn't think that it was substantial and reasonable until the second two floors were occupied. But I think the standard is whether it's an objective person in the community would define that as
substantial. Well, he pled that since 1997, when there were heavy rains, it flooded his property. Why couldn't the court look at that and say, objectively, that would be substantial with regard to any objective person?
I guess, Your Honor, the court could make that decision, but I think that was clearly erroneous in this case. He was able to, at the time, it was just a business on the first floor. He was able to run his business without interruption. It wasn't until he built an apartment for himself on the second floor, an apartment, and luxury apartments that he was trying to rent out rental income on the third floor. Only then was it substantial and reasonable.
You wanted to save 1 minute, and
yes,
you got that point.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Scott Martin here for Alan Joyow, the appellee in this matter. Your Honors, the two questions that govern this appeal are, what is the wrong that was alleged, and when did Mr. Shin's cause of action accrue? And the answers to those questions are very straightforward and can be found in the unargued about facts. And the law to apply to those straightforward answers militate towards finding that the court got it right, Mr. Shin's claims are barred by the statute of limitations, and his complaint should be dismissed with prejudice. The only wrong alleged anywhere in plaintiff's complaint is found in paragraph 7 of the same at page 3 of the record, which states that the prior owner covered a drainage system. This caused rain to come from Mr. Shin's next-door property into his property, resulting in damage during heavy rainfall since 1997. The next question as to when did the cause of action accrue, again, is not in dispute. It can be found in appellant's brief at page 12, where he says that the statute of limitations began running in 1997 when Mr. Shin was first damaged by the defendant's building. Everyone agrees the statute of limitations for property damage claims here in Virginia, whether on trespass causes of action or nuisance causes of action, is governed by 801-243B, and there's a 5-year statute of limitations. So the only wrong alleged happened before 1997. The cause of action accrued in 1997. The complaint was not filed for 5 years thereafter. In fact, it wasn't filed until August of 2015, nearly 2 decades thereafter. Therefore, the complaint is untimely and barred as a matter of law under the statute of limitations. The pertinent legal principles to consider when applying the binding precedent of this court to those undisputed facts is set forth far more eloquently and clearly than I could ever aspire to in this court's decision from 2 weeks ago involving the Forest Lakes Community Association, the current site of 2017 VA Lexus 6. The pertinent issue that the court elucidated in that matter is that when there's a permanent structure that causes a nuisance, and the court cited Norfolk and Western Railroad v. Allen in highlighting that point, but when there's a permanent structure that causes a nuisance, as in this case, where there's a roof, when a permanent structure causes a nuisance or a trespass, those are analyzed together under the same standard, every damage that stems from that permanent structure relates back to the erection of the structure, and every subsequent damage, whether at intervals or of varying degrees and times, is governed and claimable in a cause of action for the original erection of that permanent structure that results in a nuisance or a trespass. So, if Mr. Shin had filed his lawsuit within 5 years of first incurring his damages, he could have claimed in that lawsuit not only the damages incurred up to the date of the trial for his nuisance and trespass claim, he also could have claimed reasonably expected and anticipated future damages. Mr. Shin didn't do so. He didn't bring such a claim within the applicable time frame. Therefore, his claims are barred. The appellant seeks to have this court apply the standard set forth in McDonald and Norfolk and Western Railway 118 VA 438 to this case, but his argument elides a critical factual distinction between those two actions and this case here. The critical factual distinction is subsequent human activity. Here, you have the erection of a roof, the covering of a drain pipe, and nothing else. From the time that happens pre-1997 to the time plaintiff incurs his first damages in 1997 to the time the lawsuit's filed nearly 2 decades later in August of 2015, there is no allegation of any subsequent human activity that results in damages by trespass or nuisance. That's not the case in McDonald. That's not the case in the Norfolk matter. In McDonald, there was a valve, an overflow valve for sewage that had to be operated when the sewage levels reached a certain level. It was done a handful of times over the decades. The court found that that subsequent operation, that subsequent action, gave rise to a subsequent cause of action and triggered a new statute. The same principle applied in the Norfolk case, where there was a pump. In that case, the court found that the human action of operating the pump, the action thereof, gave rise to subsequent damages and a subsequent cause of action, which triggered a new statute of limitations. That didn't happen here. There is no subsequent action alleged. It is solely the erection of a permanent structure, claimed to be a permanent menace, And under the law I just set forth, as very clearly synthesized and stated in the Forest Lakes opinion, any damages stemming from that original erection of the permanent menace are accumulating damages and compounding damages or aggravating damages, but they relate back to the original human agency, the erection of the permanent structure that is claimed to be a permanent menace. They do not, in and of themselves, every time it rained in over 20 years, trigger a brand new cause of action and a brand new 5-year statute of limitations, absent any subsequent intervening human action, which is not here. So for those reasons, we think the court got it right. We think the Forest Lakes opinion controls here. Plaintiff's complaint is barred by the statute of limitations because he sat on his remedies after first incurring his initial damages in 1997, which triggered his right to bring a cause of action for any damages incurred to date and reasonably expected to be incurred in the future. He didn't file in time. Therefore, his claims that were brought for the first time in 2015 are barred as a matter of law. And the statute of limitations should apply, resulting in the dismissal of his case with prejudice. There are other issues raised in the appellant's brief that I think warrant additional discussion and additional issues raised in our brief that I would like to highlight to the court. And the first is the special plea was both on the statute of limitations argument, which I just explained our position to the court that I believe is supported by the Forest Lakes opinion. But the second was the equitable doctrine of latches. That issue was briefed. That issue was argued. That issue was presented to the court. The court spoke through its order, which is found at page 80 of the appendix. And the dismissal order granted the special plea of statute of limitations and of latches, resulting in the dismissal of the case with prejudice. Our argument on the latches was Mr. Joyow has been living next door to this gentleman for a dozen years, has done various things to accommodate his property, but also has been prejudiced in his ability to mount a defense against plaintiff's claims because plaintiff sat on his remedy for over a dozen years. And that prejudice serves as fuel for applying the doctrine of latches to bar plaintiff's complaints herein. Again, that was briefed, that was argued to the court, that was a part of the trial court's order. Appellant has assigned no error to that finding. That separate and distinct reason for dismissal of the case with prejudice, as reflected in the trial court's final dismissal order, has not been assigned any error. Therefore, even though we think the statute of limitations argument is relatively airtight and should result in the dismissal of the case with prejudice, even if it doesn't, the separate and distinct doctrine of latches, which was heard by the trial court, which was incorporated into the trial court's dismissal order, has not been appealed and on its own should stand to dismiss plaintiff's claims with prejudice. With respect to the second assignment of error, this issue has been briefed. It was discussed with appellant's counsel. The argument seems to be that Mr. Shin either didn't go upstairs, didn't care so much, didn't use the second or third floor.
Can I interrupt you for a second?
Yes.
The latches defense would not apply to the law, common law claim for damages, right? It would only apply to the prospective relief, the injunctive and declaratory relief request.
I think that's an accurate interpretation of the law, Your Honor.
So, but the complaint asks for both, right?
It does. It does ask for an injunction, Your Honor.
So maybe I misunderstood what you said a moment ago. How could latches moot the statute of limitations issue vis-a-vis the common law damage claim?
Well, the argument is that if the court made an error, the trial court made an error in using the equitable doctrine of latches as grounds for dismissal both of the injunctive claim and of the compensatory damages claim, which is what the court did. If that was error, no error was assigned to that.
So
the trial court.
Can I flesh it out with you for a second?
Yes, Your Honor.
So you think there's a chance that the trial judge thought that the equitable doctrine of latches applied to a common law action for damages?
I know what the trial court thought only by what the order says, which is that the special plea and bar statute of limitations and latches is granted. Therefore, the entirety of the case is dismissed with prejudice. I think I agree with the court that the application of the binding precedent to that issue of law militates towards latches serving as a bar to the equitable claim for relief and not the legal claim for relief. But that wasn't clarified in the court's order, and to the extent there was error in the court's order in that regard, it was neither preserved nor presented to this court.
Well, I'm assuming your plea and bar did not argue to the trial court that if you find latches, then you can dismiss the common law damage claim.
That's right. The special plea, as well as the special plea, was a single paragraph. The brief is what fleshed out the issues, and that brief addressed all of the issues involving the statute of limitations and the common law damage claim, as I've addressed at the beginning of my oral argument here, as well as the equitable relief sought and the bar thereto by the doctrine of latches. Finally, Your Honors, with respect to the nuisance claim and the second assignment of error levied by appellant, as I began to state, that the gist of the argument is because to Mr. Shin, the damages that he incurred ever since 1997 did not upset Mr. Shin. Mr. Shin didn't have a cause of action beginning in 1997. It wasn't until Mr. Shin wanted to renovate his second and third floors that a cause of action for nuisance arose, because that's when it became a substantial interference to Mr. Shin. It's all subjective to the plaintiff himself, and there is absolutely no adequate explanation, as far as I've read or heard, as to why the objective standard found in the binding precedent, including the Foley case cited in my brief at 223 VA 28, which says that the standard for nuisance is one which would upset a normal member of the community, or in the Herring case, the one at 106 VA 173, where it says that there's a reasonable man standard that should be applied to claims of nuisance. In this case, as pled in the complaint, in 1997, because of something allegedly wrong with the neighbor's house, Mr. Shin's property began to incur damages, water runoff resulting in water damages during heavy rain. By any reasonable standard, by any objective standard, that could have constituted a nuisance at that time. Thus, Mr. Shin's subjective feelings on the matter should not be considered by the court. Only the objective findings in the facts that are not in dispute, and applying that standard from the law, you find that his cause of action was triggered in 1997. Sometimes I think it's helpful to look at issues like this from the flip side. If Mr. Shin had filed in 1997 for nuisance, and the defense was, there's no nuisance here, you never go to the second or third floor, you barely even use that property, you barely even see what water damage comes in, surely that defense would have failed, because the court would have found under the binding precedent of this court that the standard to apply to determine whether a nuisance cause of action has been triggered is an objective one. And objectively, water flowing from the neighbor's house into the adjoining property beginning in 1997, nearly two decades before the lawsuit was filed, triggered a cause of action for nuisance. So we think that the facts of the case, when applied to the binding precedent, are clear-cut. This was a permanent structure done nearly two decades before the lawsuit was filed. Any damages that began in 1997 triggered the cause of action and the statute of limitations for Mr. Shin. That is conceded in Mr. Shin's brief. There's a five-year statute of limitations period following the triggering of that statute of the cause of action. The lawsuit wasn't filed within that statute, not even close. It wasn't until 2015 when it was filed. Therefore, because any damages incurred following that initial damage by the permanent structure nuisance would be merely compounding, accumulating, or aggravating damage, the cause of action and the statute of limitations was triggered the first time the damage was incurred in 1997. The complaint was untimely. It's barred as a matter of law under the statute of limitations and should be dismissed. If there are no questions, I'll submit this to the court.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Your Honors, I disagree that the nuisance was the covering of the drainage pipe on the defendant's roof in 1997. The nuisance is the discharge of the water on my client's roof. The standard, the part cited by appellee's counsel is that the structure was permanent, and that's not a change of law. That's what Norfolk says. Norfolk says if the structure is permanent and it's unlawful, it's a nuisance. If it's, well, what Norfolk and McDonald both say is that we need to look at what the act is that creates a nuisance. When Mr. Joya, or when the person who owned the building before Mr. Joya covered that water, covered that drainage on the defendant's roof, that did not cause a nuisance. There was no damage then. My client could not have brought a cause of action then It was not until the rain collected, discharged onto my client's roof. So therefore, we would ask that the court overrule the trial court's decision.
Call the next case.